Welcome to A More Beautiful Life Collective. We know that in the hectic hurry of everyday life, it's easy to lose sight of what really matters. This is a moment to pause and realign your focus on the one who gives us peace and rest. We are focusing on discipleship, productivity, and homemaking as we live with eternity in mind. This is the place where you'll learn to create a life you love and cultivate your heart for God. Hello and welcome to A More Beautiful Life Collective podcast, season 1, episode 7. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening and leave a 5-star rating and review to help people find this podcast. Also, you can visit the blog to read more God-centered content and to subscribe to the monthly newsletters. This episode is brought to you by the Guthrie Grove Pickleball Club. Each week, the club meets for fellowship and friendly competition at the Williamson Springwater Park on Mondays and Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. Pickleball is a great exercise and it's easy to learn. You could check out the blog for our pickleball power rankings and see if you'll make it yourself. Come join the fun. Now onto the episode. So we've been talking about habits on the podcast, and we've been focusing on different areas where we can include habits into our lives that can lead to a spiritually vibrant life. Much of the habits that we've been focusing on have been focused primarily on our individual lives. But as we discussed in the last podcast, our habits don't occur in a vacuum. Each of our actions impacts someone else. We have to be aware of the impact of our actions, and we need to consider how we can create habits that will trigger growth and goodness in the lives of those around us. So in the last podcast, we talked about why we are all homemakers. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, you are creating a place where you are creating home, and you're doing that in your own context. Your goal should be to make a home that reflects the gospel to those around you and points them towards God. Your home allows you to give glory to God. So today we're going to build on that, and we're going to consider rhythms and routines that your individual home can include as a family unit. Now, these are not personal spiritual disciplines, though you see how some of these disciplines are related to the habits of spiritual disciplines that we've talked about earlier in the podcast. Importantly, these two things work together, hand in hand, to create a deep, long-lasting relationship with God. We need both these communal practices and these individual practices of discipleship, worship, and fellowship. And you may find that you prefer one or the other. You may lean towards Bible reading and prayer on your own, but it may be a struggle for you to connect in Bible study or prayer with other people. Or you may feel like the opposite. Maybe you love going to church, you love doing worship, but you really struggle with being daily committed to that quiet time. But regardless of if you prefer one side or the other, if you do that, you'll have a lopsided view of God. Your relationship with Him won't be as rich as it could be if you facilitate both in your life. And so what we're going to be doing as we talk about these communal habits is we're going to be focusing on three habits that you can include in your life today to create a spiritually vibrant home for all those in your household. And these habits are going to, they fall under a big bracket of how you can connect with your family. But what they include is a daily common meal, family devotions, tea times, and regular celebrations and family traditions. And so what we're going to be doing today is just focusing on family meal times. And then in the next podcast, we're going to discuss these other rhythms, routines, and habits that will help you to create this home that points others to Christ. They're going to create this rhythm of remembrance in your family that builds your family culture, and it draws you closer to each other and to God. So like I said, in the last podcast, everyone can benefit from adding these habits to your life. You don't have to have a spouse and 2.5 kids to create a life-giving home in your life or to have these life-giving habits in your life. I think actually it's better to start them now in whatever context you are in, because I think that just like with the habit of reading your Bible and daily finding time to pray or anything like that, if you start now, you are going to be able to build this habit and this routine, and it's going to become deeper and more consistent if you make it a priority and then set a system in place to make it a repetitive routine in your life. You'll find that the longer you have the system, the easier it will be to continue that system through the disruptions in your life. As anyone who has kids will tell you, things don't get easier when you have kids, it just gets harder. Things don't get easier as you get older and you get married, it just gets harder. So if you have these routines now, then later on, whenever there's a major disruption in your daily routine, like having a newborn or something else, it'll be easier to follow. It's easy to let all your habits go out the window sometimes if they're not very strong and if you're not very consistent in them. But it's important to have a strong system already in place so that you will continue to follow it, even if you have to kind of strip it down to the basics for a time. I was recently reading a fiction book that described a really broken father who had been an addict at the time of his birth. In the novel, he was ashamed to go and see his daughter and his wife because he didn't want to be the father who was a deadbeat dad. So he just never showed up. And finally, after he went through rehab, he succeeded with it. He held his daughter in his arms. And this was months after she was born. In the book, he said this line, "I knew then that I didn't need to be perfect. I just had to continue to work towards this best version of myself so that I could be the best father that I could be right now. And as long as I'm working towards that best version of myself," he knew that he was going to do all right. And I think that this is true for us as well. We have this image in our minds of what it means to be a good Christian or a mom or a dad or a sister or a brother or a daughter or an employee or a boss. And sometimes we beat ourselves up because we don't reach this ideal. And we beat ourselves up so much that we end up not trying. We stop trying. And what I find is that if we change our mindset and we simply start working towards the best version of whatever that thing is, whatever that title is that we want to achieve, whether that's a Christian or mom or dad, if we work towards this best version of ourselves right now, we're going to continue to move forward. I think this can give us the peace that we need to fight perfectionism, where we don't feel like we need to be perfect to achieve these things. But it can also give us a kick in the pants too. If you look at your life, are you working towards being the best version of yourself right now? Or do you feel like you're kind of spiraling outside, out of control, but you just feel like, well, I'll fix all this stuff later? I think the first step is to always develop that daily quiet time that we talked about before. And that will strengthen your relationship with God and it will help you to grow. But then I think the next step is you need to develop accountability within community. And part of how you do that is to have those communal spiritual disciplines that we're going to talk about today. According to Don Everts, more than a quarter of U.S. adults live alone, and it's not uncommon to live where no one regularly comes into their home. What psychiatrists call chronic loneliness is a very common problem in modern American life, although most patients suffering from it prefer the diagnosis of depression to that of chronic loneliness, the phenomenon is significant and dangerous. I think right now we feel like we're in this society that is full of depression and anxiety, and we wonder why that is. And I think part of it is what we've talked about before with technology, but I think the other part is that we are increasingly becoming more individualized. But another way of saying individualized is that we're becoming more isolated. And so in that isolation, we are creating this society where we are depressed and we are lonely and we don't know how to fix it. There's a book called Bowling Alone that talks about this. And so I think when we go on our own way outside of this community, we can easily become depressed and isolated. And we can also find ourselves stuck in negative thoughts and actions that can lead down dark paths, that if we had someone with us, they could pull us out of that. Justin Whitmore Early describes the habits that we can create. And he says that they can be the exact opposite of the loneliness that can destroy us. He says this, in regular rhythms of coming together, we don't just find these things out. We also find each other. When we set up these regular routines and rhythms, we don't need to be perfect, and we can rest in the fact that as long as we are working towards a deeper relationship with God, that best version of ourselves, and deeper relationships with each other, we're going to do all right. We're going to be moving forward. So let's think about this. Okay, what does this look like practically? How can we create these rhythms and routines? So I mentioned before, as we've talked about habits, that the first thing that you need to do with habits is you need to figure out the keystone habit that you can create that can lead to a cascade of better choices. When it comes to family culture, I think the keystone habit that I found in all the books and podcasts and articles and all the things that I read is the daily family meal. In both Habits of the Household and Spiritually Vibrant Home, that book by Dawn Everts, the authors emphasize a daily family meal. They write, numerous studies have linked family meals to all sorts of positive family outcomes, from better academics to better behavior and reduced drug and alcohol abuse. They've also heard the thing that most Rhodes scholars, the thing that they have most in common was that their families ate together. Dawn Everts found in his study of Christian households that the families who were spiritually vibrant shared one amazing thing in common. They had loud tables. In fact, Sally Clarkson has also talked about this, and she credited her mealtimes as the thing that led to spiritual vibrancy in her children. She states that they were loud because they discussed and debated great ideas from religion, philosophy, art, books, and they coupled that with their frequent read-alouds. Her kids are all still Christians, and many have become writers and authors, speakers. They have degrees in theology and music and a lot more. And so she wrote a book about this, and she called the book The Life-Giving Table. And it describes why family mealtime is so important to discipleship. So taken from all the books that I've just mentioned, here are some ideas why mealtime is crucial and what it can show us about ourselves and about God. So first, eating, it cultivates several different things in our lives. Obviously, we need to eat food to live. But on top of that, we learn several things that are kind of deep theological truths about ourselves and about how we relate to the world around us and to God. So first, eating cultivates a sense of presence between those around us and ourselves. So while we're eating, we are physically present, and we have to be physically present. And so generally, we're not thinking about our to-do list and our phones. We're not trying to be a million places at once. We're grounded. Eating can be a grounding process. We are here, we have to be present, and we have to be human. And some of the reasons why is what we'll get into. So first, eating cultivates a sense of dependence on God. So I think in our modern age, we are constantly trying to be our own God. And due to technology, sometimes we think that we can actually do that. But just like the engineers of the Titanic, when we attempt to spit in God's face and say, nope, you know what? We got this. We're better than you. And exalt ourselves over him, we might find our ship sinking. And so I think eating puts us back into our place. Much of what we eat is outside of our control. I think sometimes in modern life, we try to act like we have everything under control. And because of our abundance, we may feel like that sometimes. But really, none of that is true. It's really just a facade. If you've ever grown a garden, you know how there are trials and tribulations where things just don't thrive. And it's because we can't make it thrive. I started some seeds this year. I probably started like 50 seeds. And out of all those 50 seeds, I think I had like 3 plants. I don't even know if any of my vegetables actually survived because I could do a little bit. And some of the stuff I did very wrong, which is why they didn't do well. But you know, God makes it grow. And so I think we have to daily remind ourselves of what gives us sustenance. I think Jesus emphasizes this in the Lord's Prayer whenever he says, give us our daily bread. We need to know that we depend on God. And I also think that this helps us to understand our need of food and our subsequent dependence on God as a physical reminder of our need for our spiritual food. I think there's a reason why, you know, Jesus says, you know, this is my daily bread, is to do the work of his father and to also have this scripture. And so I think that us acknowledging our need for food, we are also reminding ourselves of our need for God. Eating also, in addition to this, it cultivates a sense of dependence on each other. So I follow quite a few homesteading blogs and groups and stuff on Facebook. And after COVID-19 and all of the fallout with that, I keep seeing more and more people saying, you know what, we need to be self-sufficient and self-sustaining. And so I think that, you know, really they're taking up this old American call, you know, I think it was Emerson or something that said that we needed to be self-reliant. But I think in some ways, you know, that goes back to this isolationist idea. It's kind of the opposite of what I'm talking about here. I think if we, like, I think it's good to grow your own food because it shows you your dependence on God, that you are not in control of anything. But I think wanting to grow your own food to say, hey, I don't need to rely on anybody, I think that's foolhardy. I don't think that's a good goal. I think it's important to practice sustainable practices, but I don't think it's realistic to say that you can make everything yourself. I think nobody in society has ever been able to do that. And if you try to do everything yourself, you're going to end up going without some things because there's just no way that you would have enough time to do that. Even if you had the skill to do it, you don't have enough time to make all your meals and all your soap and clothing and shelter. Not to mention other things like entertainment. Try to make that on your own. You would just go without that or other entertainment. I think what we need to recognize instead of this goal, pursuing this goal of self-sufficiency, is we just need to recognize that we live in a village, that we have to rely on other people to help us to get our food. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to be in community because I think our food, our table, what we have on the table, is another symbol of this unity and diversity, a symbol of God and of the church, that each of us have these gifts that we can contribute to the table. And we all have to contribute it to the table so that we can eat. But each person is unique in their abilities and their capabilities. And that uniqueness is also beautiful. I think, you know, we could think about this globally or locally as people produce certain things and have certain jobs. But you can also think about this as your children have these jobs. I think it's good for them to see that everyone has to contribute to a role. I was listening to something and it was talking about how people in other countries, you know, raise their children. And one of the things that they talked about is that their kids needed to have a job. And so they actually don't praise their kids. What they do instead is they just kind of expect them to help out around the house. But in doing that, they are basically, the kids feel like they are capable. Because they feel like they're capable, they get the intrinsic satisfaction of that. I think we can think about this with our table. We should expect our kids to cook and clean and contribute to the table. And it's not necessarily something that we should praise them for. You say good job and things like that. But I think it's important that they feel capable for that and they feel valued and they feel like they're contributing to the family unit and the family culture. And then I think seeing that, it will have a ripple effect of, look, this is how you act in community. You never just expect that you are going to get something. Instead, you have to give something back. You recognize your need for community, and you also recognize this need to serve other people. In addition to this, eating cultivates our sense of dependence on creation. Obviously, I think it makes us more mindful of where our food comes from, of the work that goes into our food. I think too often and we'll talk about this in just a minute, but I think too often kind of our baseline is we want to eat while we are consuming some kind of entertainment, whether that's, you know, watching Netflix or looking at our phones. But I think if you just sit in front of the TV every night and binge watch a show while you eat, you can finish a whole meal without like really tasting anything. And I think the same goes for meals on the go. Like if you're driving in a car, you can eat everything and you're getting, you know, the nutrients or the calories, but you're not really enjoying it. And sometimes that's necessary. You know, if you're car schooling or if you're going and you're the carpool person as you go from work to home to sleep and then back again. But I think that mindless consumption, it can really lead, I mean, obviously to physical problems, but it can also lead to just negative problems for the family as a whole if you're mindlessly consuming things and you're never stopping to really be thankful for that thing. So I think part of what I find as I look through all of this is that what you need to do with your family is you need to be mindful and intentional. You also need to be cultivating a sense of gratitude for God, for your community and family and the gifts God has given you from the earth. I think of that, you know, one of the lessons I can learn from how we deal with creation is the stewardship that we need to have. So every part of how we view our food, you can take a larger life lesson from that. I think we recognize that entitlement is a big problem for our youth and ourselves, honestly. And so part of this entitlement is that we never have never needed to be uncomfortable about anything. Whatever we want, whether it's Chick-fil-A or ice cream or hot Cheetos, I can get it on my phone in less than 20 minutes with DoorDash or Instacart. And we feel like with everything at our fingertips, we stop feeling grateful for what we have and we feel like we deserve it. And once we feel like we deserve it, then it feels like it's something that is necessary for survival. And we assume that we cannot live without it. And so I think these family meals, they help us to pause and be grateful for these things, be thankful for these things, to know that we don't deserve these things, but they're good gifts from God. And so it helps us to live with gratitude and with mindfulness in our lives. Justin Whitmore Early states this: the daily habit of eating at least one meal with others is important precisely because it asks us to rearrange our priorities around the communal table and to acknowledge that we were made for food and for each other. So we see why eating, that the fact that we were made for food is not something that we need to say is bad. I think sometimes we even though none of us really believe this, we kind of believe like what the ascetics believe, that we need to, all of the pleasures in life, we should kind of discard, that we shouldn't appreciate those things, that yeah, food may taste good, but really we should, just be eating salad all day and never eat anything good that brings us pleasure because pleasure is bad. But I don't believe that. I don't think that's the case. I think God made us for food and he made food taste good. And we see why, because of all of those things that eating itself teaches us. There's a reason why we need to eat, and we need to eat so much and so frequently. But I think rearranging our priorities where it's not just food for sustenance, food to survive. Instead, food to thrive means we also say that we are made for each other. And so food, if you say, hey, whenever I eat, I have to eat with somebody else, you're automatically building in that community there. And that's why eating together is a keystone habit. Because if you say every time that I eat, or at least one time a day, whenever I have that big communal meal, I'm going to meet with somebody, you are going to have that reminder, that trigger of I need to eat today. And so this is the time where I'm going to eat. So whenever I eat, I'm going to remind myself to connect with somebody. And you're going to see the benefits of this connection later on. But this can help you to not only remind yourself of your dependence on God and each other and on the world and your community, but also it can remind you to connect with somebody so that you don't become depressed and isolated. So let's stop and think practically about what this means for you. Remember, even if you live with just your spouse and have no kids, or you live with roommates, or you live alone, you can always work towards having a meal with someone. You might just have to get creative. So your meal could be with coworkers. In fact, while I was working, my daily meal at lunch with my coworkers, even though it was like 2 minutes long because I was a teacher, it was the highlight of my day. Or, for you, it could be with a friend or a family member that you get together with. You may find that something like this needs to happen like once a week. If you live alone, you may not be able to get together with someone every day, but you could say, once a week, I'm going to try to get together with someone and have that meal, or maybe a couple times a week. Just like he said, Don Everts, he said that some people never have people come into their homes. We're going to talk about hospitality in a future podcast, but this is something where if you do live alone, think about how you can work to connect with somebody. But I think especially if you live with roommates, it's important to try to get together with them. So even though, I'm thinking of this and I'm thinking of young families because that's my situation, I definitely think that you could also have this in your life even if you are not in the same situation as me. I think the goal is to be working towards the ideal, but it's never a rigid requirement. So the ideal in this situation is a daily meal, but it's never a rigid requirement that you have to eat at the table every day. It's just a goal. So how can you make this happen? Number one, you need to get to the dinner table. First, you have to assess where you're currently at with your family mealtime routines. What do your current daily meals look like? Do you normally have at least one meal that you eat with your family? Or do you feel like your ship's passing in the wind where everybody's going on their own way and you never really eat with them? Are your family meals normally around the dinner table? I think one of the best ways that we can determine this habit is by tiny habit. And so I think the tiny habit with this is to get to the dinner table. So one time, a designated time each day, you establish the time and place of where you're going to have dinner. Or I've heard some people, especially if you homeschool, you have more of an opportunity to do this. But, you know, if you're working after school or your kids are working, or if you find that you get home really late, you may want to do this for breakfast or maybe lunch. Or, you know, if you're doing a once a week kind of thing, working up to a daily meal, maybe you would choose like Sunday dinner. But you need to establish a time. So let's say for us, we're going to say dinner, but again, you could say, no, we're going to do breakfast together. But you say, okay, every day at 6 o'clock, we're sitting at the dinner table, no questions asked, or maybe it's 6:30 or 7. And so you haven't determined anything else, how long you're going to be eating, what you're going to be eating, but you're just sitting at the dinner table every day. And there you can work on some other areas of your family meal time. It could be that you're having mac and cheese every day or ramen every day, but you're just sitting together and seeing what happens. And I think if you start that habit and you make that a rhythm and routine in your life, you'll find that it's easier to make it longer and more complicated as time goes on. I think the second thing is you need to limit the devices. So you need to think about the atmosphere of your home and kind of what's going on. So do you have the TV on in the background or do you turn it off? I always think of the story of Matilda with this. So she lived, it's the Roald Dahl novel, Matilda. And so she lived with this family and every night she had TV dinners. And if she tried to talk or tried to do anything else, you know, they would like yell at her. And so I hope this is not the case for us, but I know that whenever I got married, that's what I did every day. I got into the habit in college of, you know, disappearing into my room. You know, I didn't want to eat in the dining hall all the time. And so I would take my lunch and then I would turn on a Netflix show and that just became my habit. And so that was something that I carried on into married life. And then whenever I had my son, I started doing the same thing. Then his high chair was way too messy in the living room. And so I was like, oh, I guess we'll eat at the dinner table. And then after eating at the dinner table, then a lot of other things started happening where it's like, okay, we're not going to watch Netflix anymore. And then we started focusing on adding some of these other things. And so, you know, limiting those devices, it made room for other habits in our life. So Early says this, the difference between people who happen to live together and families who befriend each other are the rhythms of conversation at mealtimes. So I think if phones and other devices are allowed at the dinner table, you could potentially be harming your ability to have those deep conversations. Sherry Turkle, we mentioned this in a previous podcast, but Sherry Turkle, who is the author of Reclaiming Conversation, says that to start a meaningful conversation, you need to have at least 7 minutes of conversation time. But if you have a phone that distracts you, basically your clock starts over. And so if you're constantly letting devices interrupt your family meal times, you may be creating a barrier between you and the people that you love. The next thing that you need to do is you need to strike up a conversation. So if you're consistently getting to the table and limiting access to the devices at the dinner table, I think you need to focus on creating conversations around family meal times that's enticing. Basically, it should be something that causes people to linger over your dinner and sit and savor it. And so you need to think about this. How long are your family dinners? Do you sit around the dinner table long enough to get to those 7 minutes that Turkle talks about? It can be helpful to set a time expectation for your dinners. Obviously, you know, for toddlers, it's going to be shorter than you would have for teens. And with toddlers, you don't really need that time expectation so much. But I think as your kids get a little bit older, you need to have the expectation that you're going to sit and you're going to talk. It's not, hey, I need to rush through dinner so I can get back to, you know, my game or something else. Instead, no, it's that this dinner time is important. It's one of the most important parts of your day. And so you treat it as such. Susan Schaefer-McCauley, she's the author of For the Children's Sake, she said actually that she had 2 dinners every night. So this goes back to the toddler versus teen question, especially if you have children that range have a wide range of ages. So she had several children and each night the younger children had an early dinner. And then after the toddlers were put to bed, she had an older dinner. A dinner for the older children. And so they would get to stay up. Once a child got to that age where they could stay up. It was like a special privilege and they had this like celebration. And so, you know, I can't imagine doing this just from, you know, my experiences of like a working mom. And even now, you know, I'm so tired at the end of the day. I can't imagine having two dinners every night. But this might be something that if you do have a wide range of kids, especially ones that can help out, that could be a way to incorporate some more adult conversation. And so you don't always have to deal with, you know, kids throwing spaghetti and things like that. But you can also make sure that you teach, you know, those manners. And I think one way of making the table enticing for every age group so you don't have to do two dinners is that you have a ritual that kind of goes along with your dinner time so that it signifies, okay, this is mealtime. It's about to start. And so it kind of signifies, okay, my expectations are a little bit different for what you are allowed to do. Early recommends having that ritual. And so what he does is he lights a candle and then he says something at each time that he lights a candle. And so this reminds his kids that it's mealtime. And again, that way you have these expectations. So if you know you have a toddler, as soon as they're old enough to kind of understand this and comprehend it, you say, hey, during mealtime, you have to stay at your seat and this is what's appropriate. And so then having other kind of rhythms will help you with this. So, you know, your goal for family dinners, the whole reason why you do this is to have that conversation because through those conversations, you are discipling your kids. And so that means you actually need to have some kind of conversation. You need to have something that fills the silence. And for some of you, this isn't even something you need to worry about because it is going to happen regardless. Maybe you have a dinner table that you want to direct and corral the conversation so it can be something that's enjoyable. But, you know, I'm someone who's quiet and I'm married to someone who's quiet. And so, you know, our son is talkative, but, and our daughter is one, so she's not really saying anything, but that's something that, you know, there's some dinners where it's kind of quiet and there's not much that we're saying. And so you can, regardless of whether you are a super talkative family and nobody can get a word in edgewise or you're super quiet, I think it's important to kind of plan for your family dinner times and you think about what to say and what you want to talk about. Early recommends doing a rose and thorn for each day. So basically your rose is your high point in the day and then your thorn is your low point. And this way everyone is expected to share and everybody knows that they're going to share. And so he goes around the dinner table. So then that way, if you have some kids who are super talkative and others that are quiet, the super talkative one doesn't just steamroll the whole conversation. Every person has to contribute to the conversation. They get their practice in. You know, this is teaching them how to communicate with each other and with adults. So your dinner time is like a practice for conversation every day. And so you're practicing from a young age how to talk with each other. And so this way, you know, if you do something where each person has to share and they know they have to share, so they kind of prepare for it, you know, maybe even subconsciously every day, it can be beneficial for them. It also can help you keep track of kind of what's going on around your kids, both what they like, because that would be their high point, but also it might help you to identify maybe some prayer needs or requests or things that they need from you based on like their thorn. You also have to kind of keep tabs on what you and your spouse are discussing. You might want to, you know, have some topics that are labeled like do not discuss. You don't want dinner time to become a complaining session or something that makes your kids worried that they're internalizing things that they really shouldn't hear. And this is something for me, you know, I'm just getting to that point where my kids are understanding what I'm talking about. I have to remind myself of this frequently because sometimes I'll just start talking about something and I really shouldn't talk about it in front of the kids. So for you, what this can mean is think about what you would want to talk about. You can have your rose and your thorn, but you could also think of maybe about a Bible story that you read or a character trait you wanted them to have or a political event that you wanted to talk about. You're building your child's or your spouse's or your friends or your own worldview. And so you're showing those people what you're thinking about and what it means to be a thinking, feeling Christian in today's culture. And so our last way that we can create these family mealtimes that can be life-giving and lead to this discipleship is we need to have a life-giving atmosphere around the family table. So just like I said, we want our family table to be someplace where they want to sit and savor. And our conversation is going to be a big thing that leads to that. But then you also want to take stock of everything else that's going on around your family table. So think about this. How would you describe the atmosphere of your table? Is it tense? Is it carefree? Is it loving or hate-filled? Is it distracted or peaceful? So the atmosphere of our table is the subconscious ways, the subtext that we are using to teach our kids what it means to follow God. So if we talk about the great power of God, but then our conversation is about how we are overwhelmed and in despair and we just keep complaining about our situation, our kids are going to see that disconnect. If we're trying to teach them to love one another, but we are constantly complaining about someone we work with or a family member, they're probably going to take away that it's okay to say one thing and then do another. And so we never want to teach our kids to just give lip service and not follow through. And that's why it's important to be mindful of our conversations, because the topic and tone of our conversation is going to directly impact the atmosphere of the table. And it's going to basically, you're shepherding your kids. And so you're going to shepherd them in a direction that you don't want them to go. I think in addition to this, you need to take stock of what's going on around the dinner table. So everyone is going to have a different goal for what they want their dinner table to look like. And you could think of it right now. What is your ideal dinner? Does it have candles? Is it a dinner on the back porch? What type of food is it? Is there music in the background? Who's sitting there with you? I think imagining this ideal can be beneficial because it's something that you can work towards. Again, depending on your situation, you know, you might not have steak and lobster every night if you have a toddler. You may not have candles if you have a toddler, because I had a candle one time and my son tried to throw a paper napkin in it. And so we had to put out almost fire at our table. So there are things that can happen depending on that atmosphere, especially with toddlers. Or, you know, if you are a college student, you might not have these really ornate meals. If you're just learning how to cook, same thing. But there are going to be things that, looking at the ideal, you can see what's important to you. So if it's messy in the kitchen, but you might find, you know what, I really don't care if it's messy. I don't care if it's all clean, because maybe what's valuable to you is a home-cooked meal. Or maybe for you, a home-cooked meal isn't really that important. You would rather have a good conversation instead. And so you want to have somebody there. So I think you can see, as you look at your ideal, what's important to you. Is it the type of food? Is it how clean it is? Is it that there's candles? Is it that around the table is picked up? Maybe it's all of those things. But what you can do today is you can create an atmosphere that you want, and then you can start doing small baby steps to get to that point. So you could start with a list of maybe creating some good go-to topics to discuss. If you want good conversation, try to find some good fodder for your conversation. Or maybe you say, okay, I really love this idea of candles at the dinner table. So go to Amazon, buy some candles. Maybe it's that you want to take 5 minutes to straighten up around the kitchen or around your table before you sit down to eat, because you like to have a more clean and decluttered space. That's great. You can make a playlist of your favorite songs to have going on in the background. That's another great option of setting that atmosphere, especially if you're quiet, because then that kind of gives something that's going on during the lull in conversation. So all of this is to say, I think it's important to remember that what you have now, your current status quo, doesn't have to be your status quo for forever. If you have a vision of what you want your home and your life to look like, you can make small daily steps to get closer to that vision than what you ever have dreamed that you would be able to do. But first, you have to determine what you want. And then you have to commit to moving forward daily, however small. Family mealtimes are important. They are a keystone habit that create our family culture that disciplines your household to become spiritually vibrant. So, how do you want your mealtimes to look? What are your goals for your family mealtimes? You can comment on this episode to keep the conversation going. If you comment, we'll read your review or your comment or question during the next podcast, and I'll respond to it. Don't forget, leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. This helps other people find the show, and it can help us to grow. And you can also go and look at the blog for more encouragement. You can subscribe to the newsletter there. And like I said, you can check out the Pickleball Powerball rankings for the Guthrie Grove Pickleball Club. You can join them at 6:30 on Mondays and Thursdays in the Williamston Springwater Park. All right, I'll see you next week. Bye. Thanks so much for joining me at a More Beautiful Life Collective podcast. I hope you go and create a life you love and cultivate your heart for God. I'm Casey Fletcher, and I hope you'll join me next week.